You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. So imagine a world where you have the rise of a rich, eccentric Republican presidential candidate, the use and misuse of encryption and high-tech software in a White House race, the secret power of Russian intelligence, and illegal ties to foreign governments. Sound familiar? Well, if you've been paying attention to anything going on in the news today, this would sound like something that we're all dealing with here in Washington, D.C. in the United States. But this is actually the plot of a book that came out long before and was conceived months, if not years before, the current events are taking place. High Hand has all of this and more. Curtis J. James, the author of High Hand, is actually a pseudonym for three men, each from very different career disciplines. Curtis Harris is a world-renowned cancer scientist. He delivers lectures and collaborates with researchers around the globe. He is the chief of the Laboratory of Human Carcinogenesis at the NIH National Cancer Institute and serves as editor-in-chief of the scientific journal Carcinogenesis. Almost said it right both times. James Rosen is an award-winning political journalist. He has covered the major stories of our era, from the collapse of the Soviet Union to the post-9/11 wars and the current military campaign against the Islamic State. He's based here in Washington, D.C. with the McClatchy Company and its 29 daily newspapers, including my hometown newspaper, the Miami Herald. And he previously served as a Moscow correspondent for United Press International and is fluent in Russian. James Ellenberger is a former senior official of National Labor Federation. He served in numerous positions at the AFL-CIO, including Asian representative and assistant director for occupational safety and health. He later served as deputy commissioner of the Virginia Employment Commission under former governor and now very prominent U.S. Senator Mark Warner, who is finding his name, for those that didn't know him around the country, as a main player on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So thank you, gentlemen, for taking the time to talk to us here and spend a couple minutes with us on Spycast talking about this book. So I want to throw out the obvious question. You essentially, with some bits and pieces and literary license changes, predicted the 2016 election from years ago. I mean, this book did not come together. There are a lot of books that have come together at the last minute about the election that were written in about 3 weeks that came out right before November 2016. But this book was conceived quite some time ago. So I'll start with you, Jim Rosen. Since there's two gems, it's always going to be interesting. Where in the world did this idea come from?
Well, Kurt Harris, my co-author, had the main idea for the book and originally approached me, and we brought in Jim Ellenberger soon thereafter. But the idea developed as the three of us worked on it together. But we did start with the core idea of, when we started writing the book, Russia was complete, and we were actually worried about this. Russia had fallen off the front pages. I'm a former Moscow correspondent, so I remember when Moscow and U.S.-Soviet relations were on the front page of newspapers every single day. So things had changed. Russia had kind of fallen off the map in terms of news. That started to change with Russia's incursion into, to some degree, into Georgia in 2008, but really into Ukraine a couple of years ago. It came back on the map, and now, obviously, things have escalated.
So Kurt, let me kick that question to you, since you had what was the original idea that spurred all this on?
The original idea was that I have these squash buddies of mine, and I thought it would be a great idea to write a novel. And the initial thought was, well, let's find some interesting characters. And one of the interesting characters was a billionaire who was from Silicon Valley and was running for president. So that was one. And then the second was, well, there's got to be a triad of other characters that would be interesting. And that led to the publisher of the L.A. Register, Thomas Hawks, his daughter, who was CIA, NOC, which is non-official cover without government protection, and the most dangerous kind of job you can have as a spy. And the third was a reporter that worked for her father. So we have this interesting triad of husband, wife, daughter, employer, employee that are in the news business. And that led to some other threads that made a connection between Roberts, the presidential nominee, and the Republican Party, and the newspaper business.
And Russia.
Yeah. And if I could add, when we started writing this, and I don't want to really reveal how long ago that was, it was prior to an upcoming presidential election. So in our minds, it made sense to look at this novel idea that we were working on in the context of the upcoming presidential election, to sort of say, oh, well, people will be interested in national politics and the upcoming election, so let's develop a character that fits into that. And hence, we developed Stuart Roberts.
Well, and I think what's interesting, let's assume that means an American presidential election, not 2016. And I think back to the 2012 election when Republican candidate Mitt Romney actually referenced Russia as the number one threat, and everyone made fun of him for it. And it's like, oh, he's so caught in the Cold War. Like, what is he talking about? Russia's the main threat. Which today we look back and say, whoops. As somebody who thought he made sense, but very, very other people did, I'm like, yeah, he's got a point. But he got hammered for bringing up Russia as a threat, even back in 2012.
Right. And I worked at the Pentagon, and there are still senior military officials today who I spoke with on background, even as Russia began to mess around with in the Ukraine and our election and so forth, who said China is a greater threat than Russia. As this plays out, China will be a greater threat. And so there's to some degree a split, I think, between the civilian and the political leadership of the country now, which really sees Russia as a threat, and the military. You know, the military, they prepare for wars,
right?
And China has been acting very aggressively, increasingly aggressively, and so it's, you know, but I think China and Russia are very different kinds of threats, and what we see Russia now is they're a threat to our core democracy because they're meddling in our elections. They're trying, maybe trying to get a certain person elected president.
Well, I mean, from the military perspective, and people have been mentioning this, that the Russian army and the Russian military is no match for NATO, no match for the United States, whereas China could certainly cause a significant problem. And from a purely military standpoint, you can potentially see their point. They're perhaps not looking more broadly than that at kind of the heart of American democracy, at what Americans believe. I mean, from looking at people in the heartland who are now buying into Russian propaganda, yep. You're seeing that more and more today, where that could potentially be a bigger threat than Chinese military.
Well, one of the things that happened was Putin, was KGB, and then came into power, and they have a new weapon, and that's cyber. And the cyber has led to false news, they've used it very effectively, and they've been using it for more than 10 years now.
And then they've used the cyber to plant fake stories on on Facebook, but the Russian skill at disinformation is legendary. It goes back, you know, even predating the Soviet regime to the Tsars when they put out the horribly anti-Semitic Protocols of Zion, which outlined a worldwide Jewish plot to take over the world. I mean, the Russians are diabolical geniuses at running massive disinformation campaigns, and this is what they're doing now. And I think they're still doing it. I don't think they're done with it.
Why stop? It works. So, right. I mean, you don't quit when you're so far ahead.
I'd like to go back to one thing that you said, Vince, about the Chinese military and high hand. We have a character in our book, a Chinese physicist who's a member of the poker group. The book revolves around a poker group that was held 12 years earlier than present-day action in the book. And to a significant degree, Professor Jin is involved with the Chinese military, and that comes out a bit in our book. We didn't develop it as much as we wanted to because it was something that sort of got cut out and left on the floor, but may appear in a future novel.
You're building characters for the sequels. I mean, that's somewhat tangential to the broader story. I mean, I can't emphasize for the listeners out there how this book predicts the current situation from at least months, if not years, prior to when the current situation is taking place. It's pretty fascinating how, I mean, you're not soothsayers. You just kind of, I'm not even sure you read the tea leaves. You just thought of arguably one of the most kind of crazy out there stories you could have put together, and now we're just seeing it in real life playing out. Let me ask you, Kurt, about you're a scientist, and the book really focuses on a lot of technical and scientific developments, technology. First of all, how much of this is based on reality? But the bigger question when you're talking about disinformation campaigns, there's a real kind of psychological element to this also, like where you're really looking at effective ways of convincing people of things, of communications. You know, you talked about cyber as a scientific, that's a tool, right? That's a tool to get information in. But the amount of time the Russians must have studied America, not only the culture, but also the kind of psychology of how to get these ideas ingrained into our belief system. Can you tell us a little bit about how that played out?
Well, first of all, it's tradecraft that the KGB teaches Putin and the other people in terms of strategy. That's one. Secondly, they've been sending people over to the United States to live and in a clandestine way to learn about the American culture. And the thirdly is social media. And social media is worldwide right now, and there are ways of manipulating it. And as Jim Rosen just said, they're very clever at doing this. And so this has been a long campaign that they've had based on knowledge of the United States, finding people in the United States that are going to cooperate with them, either knowingly or not knowingly. And that's partly what's happening in concern in our current situation here in the United States.
I think the most bizarrely exact parallel between the book and current events is that the plot is partially driven from the start with Frank Adams, the reporter, realizing that Senator Roberts made a trip to Russia some time ago after he'd made a campaign trip to Israel, but that the trip of Senator Roberts was never reported. It was never reported on any of his campaign disclosure documents, on any of his financial documents. It should have been reported. And so Frank Adams, who is a reporter for the Los Angeles Register, he's been on the Roberts presidential beat for a year. He thinks he knows everything about Senator Roberts, and he can't understand how and why Senator Roberts would have made a completely secret trip to Russia that nobody knows about, that he didn't know about. And so that part of the novel driving forward is Frank's attempt as a reporter to find out why did he go to Russia and why didn't he report it. And if you think about the demands on Mr. Trump and to disclose his and his son-in-law's past dealings in Russia, why hasn't he released his tax returns? A lot of people think that that he did business. And I mean, his I think it was Donald Trump Jr. said at some point in the past that they actually had gotten a lot of money from the Russians because they couldn't get money from American banks. And so that's a very eerie parallel, which is one of the main plot drivers of our book. And it takes Frank Adams, the reporter, quite a lot of time. He doesn't get the answer to that question. Why did Roberts go to Russia on the secret trip? Why did he not report? Until pretty far along in the book. And it seems like we are living exactly through that kind of a situation now, where everybody from the FBI to Senate Intelligence and House Intelligence Committees to the now Special Counsel Mueller is trying to answer that kind of a question about Mr. Trump.
And his associates like Flynn and others who also have been to Russia and received money for doing various things, and we're not reporting it, and are under investigation right now. The other aspect of the book is that one of the other main character is Lisa Hawks, who is this CIA agent working as a NOC, who's very much involved in finding out the inner workings of the interaction with oil companies and with money and oligarchs. And although she's keeping this a secret from her husband, Frank Adams, and so there's this dynamic of their marriage, and you know how do you go through a marriage and keep secrets from each other?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting concept because you know people have always wondered how agency personnel talk to their relatives, their close relatives. They obviously have to lie in some cases about what they do. But nowadays, and this is certainly the case prior, but even now more than ever with a lot of the leaking going on, a lot of the sources that have to be protected, journalists are in somewhat the same similar circumstances where they may get a scoop that the source really needs to be protected. And, you know, if you had a journalist married to a CIA officer, you would have that kind of back and forth with both sides not being able to tell the other what's going on. You look like you wanted to say something earlier.
Another eerie fact in our book that is being played out in events going on today is the threats against journalists and the very obvious effort going on to paint journalists as being biased and trying to represent things that did or didn't really happen. But the threats are very, very serious, and this is not new, of course, in Russia, and it's part of an important part of the book. But it's also part of how Stuart Roberts, the principal politician in our novel, is treating the press, and he's very resentful, and you can see that in his interactions with the press.
Now, every spy novel has to have some technology in it. And we have some technology that involves right at the edge of science fiction. And that's one of the interesting aspects of the spy craft, trade craft, and how that's moved forward in regards to surveillance, in regards to brain-to-computer interactions. And there's lots of things behind the scenes that we wrote about which are really very close to reality now.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, especially, Kurt, because you do have things that are right on the edge, if not already being used. And throughout the history of at least American intelligence, because we actually check ourselves every so often, there have been times when new technology has been abused in the intelligence world. I think of MKUltra as a great example of this, where trying to learn more about the mind, trying to learn more about different reactions of pharmaceuticals, and that turned into a bit of an abusive situation. You also see that different arguments are made during the science, and there was science underlying the enhanced interrogation program after 9/11. This wasn't just rando people going in there and twisting fingers off. There was a lot of planning and psychology and even neuroscience put into some of these operations. So with this technology, especially surveillance technology and other things that you do highlight in the book, but you kind of take it to that next level of things that are science fiction-y now, but in 20 minutes could be reality. how do we go about making sure, and I guess this is from every perspective, right? We have a scientist, we have a labor person kind of representing the average worker, the people of America, and also the journalist. how do we use all the different aspects of kind of the checks and balances that are outside of the government to prevent that next abuse of some of this technology? Because it's pretty scary if it's used the wrong way.
The technology is changing, and a lot of that's undercover, if you want, covert, with DARPA funding it and the CIA quality development of things that are not known to most of us. And so there has to be some vetting of when to put it into action and how far to go. And I have a lot of confidence, actually, in our intelligence community that they usually are, especially with some past experiences, are usually very cautious about. But there's a competition. The Chinese and the Russians are doing exactly the same thing. And the Israelis are doing exactly the same thing. So this is a different kind of competition. It's an arms race, but it's a technological competition. And so we have to not only be aware of what's happening, but we have to keep up. But judgment is something that I have actually a lot of confidence in the American intelligence community.
More than me, but okay. It seems like in the past there have been some of these issues being forced to being brought to the forefront. In particular, if I think of the backlash to whatever we're dealing with right now, and the time it takes for this to kind of play out. If it's clear that the Russians were heavily involved using cyber operations in influencing the election, I can see the call for a reciprocal response may require using some of these high technologies, not just cyber, but other technologies that may go beyond what we would consider. I mean, that's what you see throughout, right? The enhanced interrogation after 9/11, MKUltra right after World War II, and the Cold War is beginning. You know, whether it's developing things like napalm, for Vietnam. These are all things that, science is dual use, right? Science, there's no such thing as bad science. There's science that can be used for good and good for use for evil. Cyber is the same thing, right? The internet is created and it does wonderful things for us, right? We can look stuff up instantaneously. We can communicate over long distances, but we can also influence elections and blow up Iranian centrifuges.
We have influenced elections, but Chile, Venezuela.
Well, going all the way back to Italy in 1948, where we did it the old-fashioned way. We used the mafia to bash some kneecaps for us, but we weren't doing it in such a way that this kind of under the table. Jim Ellenberger. Let me ask you a little bit about the election itself, not necessarily the ins and outs of 2016. But as somebody who was working within the AFL-CIO, which has – it's a political organization to a degree. I know it's a labor union, but it's a political organization. How have you been able to kind of do a post-mortem on the 2016 election to a degree and see how some of this Russian disinformation could have had impact on some of the people who have been traditionally Democratic voters for generations but were swayed to vote for Donald Trump? Was it because of basic things like the economy, basic things like they saw Trump as a potentially better leader? Or can you see how Russian disinformation campaigns could have interacted with some of the rank-and-file steelworkers in Pennsylvania or some of the people in Michigan and Wisconsin?
It's a great question, and it's something that the labor movement has looked very closely at in terms of how union membership voted in the recent election. And it was not good news for labor. Traditionally, union households have voted in a neighborhood of 60% or more for endorsed candidates who are endorsed by unions. And that can be either Republican or Democrat or even independent. But in recent decades, it's been predominantly Democratic. This year was, or in 2016 was a wake-up call for the labor movement because Donald Trump did appeal to a lot of traditionally union households who supported union-endorsed candidates, and Donald Trump was not a union-endorsed candidate, at least not in any major way. I think the Fraternal Order of Police right. endorsed him. But to what extent could that have been influenced or affected by outside interference? Well, very possibly could have been, because things that were important to workers, whether they're union workers or not union workers, are jobs.
Right.
And jobs became a very key issue, and one that Donald Trump tended to gain more from than Hillary Clinton for understandable reasons. And this may or may not have been influenced or, you know, emphasized more by outside influence than we are aware of.
So this might be a blatant stereotype, but I'm also thinking that, I mean, I know people in these areas. Some of my family is from, you know, kind of the Rust Belt areas where it's labor, but it's also, you know, blue-collar workers. And the trust issue is one that is predominant. The idea of, you know, we want someone we can trust. We want somebody that we can believe in. And I can see potentially how the Russian disinformation campaign would have really hammered home that idea, where, you know, how many people trusted Donald Trump versus trusted Hillary Clinton was influenced. And you can actually see the numbers when some of these WikiLeaks stuff came out that was, you know, from the hacks of the DNC and other things, whether it was her getting the answers to the questions or the debates beforehand or the Podesta stuff. You can see, I think, how that affected kind of the middle American blue-collar worker. Is that something that you would consider as being a legitimate? Again, I don't want to stereotype too much.
But, oh, absolutely. Yeah. And trade is a key example of that. Unions have endorsed Democratic candidates who've gotten before union audiences and said, we're for jobs in the United States. And then they go and they cut trade deals, which end up harming their very important constituency. And so the trust factor that workers felt with candidates that were endorsed by their unions got weakened enormously. And clearly that can be affected by lots of ways in which outside interests or just your opponents could use that to their benefit.
Well, certainly the Republicans have been very effective over a 15-20-year history of opposing Hillary Clinton. And so I don't think they were influenced by the Russians, but the Russians added on to that to disarray the election and to lead to lack of trust of Mrs. Clinton.
Yeah, maybe it's a possibility where we can say the lack of trust was already there, the issues were already there. The Russians didn't create any new issues, but they certainly put their foot down on some ones that already existed before.
And remember, the margins in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, one or two other states were between Hillary and Trump were very small. I think a difference of 170,000 votes would have come with it. So it wouldn't have, to Kurt's point, it wouldn't have taken – there were not that many people who had to be influenced away from Hillary to change the election.
But timing is important. So hacking of the emails of her campaign and releasing that information just at the right time,
right,
which most people believe was related to Russian influence and WikiLeaks and so on and so forth. In terms of politics, that was a brilliant move on the Russians' side.
In terms of trust, the candidates themselves sort of laid the groundwork, and Hillary Clinton, was for the Asia-Pacific trade pact before she was against it.
Right.
And that didn't go unnoticed.
Right. Well, I mean, trade was huge. I mean, TPP, and you had everyone talking about getting rid of NAFTA and all these, you know, moving stuff to Mexico and other places was kind of a key component to this. That's why I think the union side is so interesting because, again, this is so not spy, but the fact that union members have been voting with the union for decades, if not like three quarters of a century until this last election, something had to have shifted. And whether it was Russian influence or not, it's going to take historians years and decades to figure it out. Let me turn back to you, Jim Rosen, because one thing that doesn't appear all that much in this book, because you had no idea how to predict it, and you know, in the sequel maybe have to deal with it, is actually the interesting battle between news agencies themselves when you're looking at stuff like RT, and you know, whether it's now even Fox News battling with their own people on air, whether now this is the time we're recording this of the back and forth about the Seth Rich murder, where Sean Hannity is continuing to, he said he's going to take a break from talking about it for the sake of the family, but this is after Fox News a day or two earlier had said we're dropping this altogether. And the, kind of the battle between the liberal-based news agencies like MSNBC, what used to be the center of the road, but CNN is now being pushed the other side, and Fox News. Now, those are American. Those are all legitimate news agencies, but the now introduction of the illegitimate news agencies, and I'll straight up say Russia Today is not a real news agency. CCTV, the Chinese version of that, not necessarily a fully legitimate news agency. They're state-run. And it makes it very easy for a politician to claim fake news when there are literally organizations out there creating fake news.
So, yes, we didn't really focus on that in the book. I mean, I think one thing, I'm fascinated about what's happening with Fox News, because my opinion is that there's so much interest among Americans in what's going on with all this Trump business, the Trump-Russia ties, the possibility of collusion, his associates having had contact with Russian intelligence officials before. There's just so much intense interest. I mean, newspaper readership is way up. Television viewership is way up. And I think what you're seeing is that if you look at the Fox viewership, the absolute hardcore zealots, if you will, who are Trump's base, okay, the people who will not give up on him, as he said, if he shot somebody on Fifth Avenue, okay, they're not abandoning Fox. But I think you have another large group of traditional Fox viewers who are not zealots, not ideologues, more pragmatic. They're conservative, but they don't want fake news. They want to know the truth. And I think they're the ones who are moving away from Fox because they don't think, and it's clear if you watch the Fox coverage of what's been going on in the last month. Fox, it's amazing to me, Fox is either ignoring all these big bombshell stories or they're explaining them away. So if you're a conservative, but you're a thoughtful conservative, and you're fascinated, as we all are, by this Trump-Russia story, I think there's a good chance you're going to say, you know what, I'm not going to watch Fox because it's not worth it. I don't learn anything from them. And I think that's the core problem of Fox, where their credibility has really been harmed on a story like this.
To go back to High Hand, one of the things we do explore and have main characters on is the oligarchs in Russia, and especially those controlling oil. And we have quite a bit of interaction between the largest oil company in the United States and the largest oil company in Russia. That might sound familiar.
And their attempts to influence elections.
And Senator Roberts, secretive Republican presidential candidate, having a relationship with one of the richest oligarchs that the American people don't know about. We hear certain things about President Trump having had a relationship with one particular oligarch. And an oligarch, not all listeners will know, an oligarch is the richest of the rich, multi-billionaires who came out, who got, you know, obscenely wealthy after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. There originally were seven oligarchs. I believe five of them were Jewish, which did not go over well with a lot of the Russian people because Russia has a history of anti-Semitism. Now there was a second generation of oligarchs, a third generation, and so forth. But this is a fairly small number of obscenely rich people, most of whom used their positions in communist Russia to claim the spoils when communism ended.
Well, I mean, Putin himself is considered to be one of the richest people in the world. And I don't think his salary is very high.
And we do have Senator Roberts, I think, as Kurt reminded us at breakfast this morning, it, correct me if I'm wrong, going to visit Putin early in the book. Yeah. Isn't that right?
Yeah, in the first 20 pages.
I'm not sure you're going to see a Donald Trump trip over to visit Putin. I can't. Well, you know what? I keep saying that there's no way.
Be careful.
There's no way that White House will make those decisions. One thing I want to kind of lay out here also is one thing people still don't quite get about modern day Russia is, and you see this when they talk about red scares and like your red baiting. This is not a communist society. You know, I Jim Ellenberger, again, going back to the labor union side, you know, your history, I mean, your big labor union, your history is really from kind of the socialist communist foundation. And you more than anybody can look at modern day Russia and say, these are not communists. These are not even left wingers. These are not labor union pro, you know, they're re-embracing Stalin and not Lenin and Marx, that's for sure.
Well, just let me comment a little bit about the link between the communist movement and the labor movement. Undoubtedly, the labor movement benefited from organizers and others who were active in the labor movement who were communist. But it became quickly known, and labor officials became very rapidly aware that the communists in their ranks were not so much interested in the particular well-being of workers, but rather in advancing their political agenda. And so most unions in the United States enacted provisions in their constitutions to throw out the communists. And communism became, you know, a dirty word in the labor movement. I used to work for Jay Lovestone, who was hired by George Meany during World War II to head up a group to aid workers in Nazi-occupied Europe. Jay Lovestone was one of the founders of the American Communist Party. And when David Dubinsky introduced him to George Meany, he said, he used to be a communist, but the son of a bitch is okay now.
So, so modern Russia today, I mean, I think that people still want to latch on to this idea of, like, if you talk about how threatening and possibly damaging the Russians can be to American democracy and American society, they're like, oh, you know, this is a red scare all over again. These are not reds.
Right.
Yeah. But I was in Moscow about 3 months ago, and one of the things when talking to a number of people in Moscow, many of them Russians, that they nationalism is really important to them. And one of them said, you know, all of us have some Putin in us, but it's about 5%. And so they want to be the greatest also, just as Trump wants the greatest.
Right.
And so they may be against Putin in terms of many of the things that he does, but they like the idea that he's strong.
You see that a bit, like, you know, you spent a lot of time in Moscow. You're basically the correspondent for UPI there. One thing I saw when I was there was this kind of revisionist history of the Stalin period, where they're forgetting the fact that he was responsible for 25 million Soviet deaths, and they're looking at this is when people feared us. This is when people respected our power. Do you see Putin really latching on to that? Do you see that it's playing with the Russian people?
Oh, you know, of course. I mean, I would say that two-thirds of our novel takes place in Moscow. And I think you get a sense of that. But, you know, as we see, nationalism, this, you know, is resurgent. I mean, Penn lost in France, but it's resurgent in France. It's resurgent in other parts of Europe. It's resurgent in Russia, as you were saying, and Kurt was saying about why Putin is so popular. It's in it, and Trump has made it resurgent here. I mean, nationalism is a very strong force internationally, and it tends to happen. It tends to be stronger when people are unhappy.
I think that you also see it in, you mentioned how the Russians are dealing with Stalinism. You know, you see the same thing playing out in our country still today, that despite the evil of slavery,
right,
and despite all the lynchings that happened throughout the South, it still is controversial to remove the Robert E. Lee Memorial in Richmond. That's still controversial. Where the Confederate flag flies in Columbia, South Carolina, is controversial. You don't see that, for instance, by contrast, you don't see that in Germany. You don't see, you don't have,
people would be very, very nervous.
Yes, yes. You don't have major political public fights in Germany over whether the swastika should still be displayed, because it's part of our heritage, which is what the Southerners say here, and what some of the Russians say now about Stalin. So I think Germany has handled this evil part of their past in a way that Russia has not, in a way that the United States has not, and in a way that other countries have not. But it's difficult. It takes a real reckoning.
So we've successfully pissed off Southerners, Fox News viewers, and who else? The trade union, everybody. Calling them communists.
Let me be clear. Let me edit what I said about the Southerners. I think the majority of Southerners do not want to see Confederate flags and memorials displayed publicly. But they are fighting against a rear guard minority that feels strongly that it is it's a legitimate part of their heritage.
It's nice that you felt the need. I pissing people off is something I do every day, so I was perfectly fine with that. But
I just wanted to be fair.
So you may
fair and balanced.
So you may or may not be able to talk about this, but as I talked about in your bio, you worked under, at the time, Governor Mark Warner, now a very important senator, working with Richard Burr as kind of the two leads for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Do you have faith that the Senate committee will get to the bottom of this based on what you know about Warner and others?
Well, I can say about Mark Warner that he is one of the most serious policy wonks I've ever met in my life. Here's a guy who would come up against an issue, and he would learn everything he could about that issue. He would delve into it to the nth degree, and he would come to meetings. He would come to the office of the Virginia Employment Commission. He was the first governor to visit the VEC office in its history when I was there. Walk into an office and say, "Hi, I'm Mark Warner. I want to thank you for all the work you're doing for the state." You know, he was a very gracious guy, very serious guy. I think he's, you know, to say he's enjoying the stage that he's on now, I don't, it might be a little far, but I think it suits him well. I'm also interested in his relationship with Richard Burr. Mm-hmm. I live in North Carolina now. I moved from Virginia almost 6 years ago, and Richard Burr is one of my senators, not necessarily that I'm a big fan of his, but I will say that I'm encouraged by his behavior as chair of the Select Committee on Intelligence.
It was tricky because he was part of the Trump transition team. He was somebody that when it went to the SSCI, people are like, you know, somebody. But they've both been very as opposed to the House, which
exactly
seemed tainted from the very beginning.
I have much more confidence in the special prosecutor and the FBI than I do of either of those intelligence committees. And those are serious people. And they don't allow, in most cases, I think, allow politics to get into their business of following the leads, following where the money goes, and asking the question, is there a crime? And they're on it right now.
Is the money the key?
Well, I just want to add about Richard Burr, because I covered him very closely. I was the Washington correspondent for the Raleigh News and Observer when Richard came to Washington, first as a member of the House, later became a member of the Senate. And I covered him very closely. I got to know him quite well. He's from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He was a medical device, if I'm remembering right, a medical device salesman. And my impression of Richard has my opinion of him has risen rose over time when I was covering him. I'll be honest, I thought he was a lightweight when I first started covering him. He didn't seem to have a lot of intellectual depth. He's very ambitious. They're all ambitious, but he's very ambitious. And I think he's now in a role that suits his ambitions. And he's conservative, but he's not Tea Party conservative. And what's interesting is he's a businessman like Trump. He comes from a business background, and I think if he can make his biggest name, and become most famous for having co-led what is perceived as a fair, honest, intelligence investigation into one of the biggest scandals of our era, that will really cement it, give him a legacy in the Senate. And I think he cares more about that than about anything else. Mm-hmm. So I think he's I have some confidence in Richard, and it seems as Jim and Kurt said that he and Warner appear to be working together fairly well.
Yeah. But in High Hand, we talk a lot about money and how people trade favors for money. And as I mentioned earlier with the oil companies. And so, yes, you follow the money. And that's sort of a general rule. I have friends who are in the FBI. That's the way they work. Because that leads them to the right people to prosecute.
Well, you can see that with Michael Flynn now, or he took unannounced or unreported funds from whether it was Turkey or Russia or other places, got him into a bit of a bind. But it's all about the payments, about the money. It's very hard to hide that kind of money, and that may be what unravels all of this in the end. In all honesty, that may be what completely vindicates Trump, that he's not behind this, but it seems like it's going to take out some of his underlings.
Well, Jared Kushner
may have some issues.
Some explaining to do. Remember, his father was, I don't know if he plea bargained or was indicted on money-related charges.
And who was the lawyer? Who was the prosecutor?
I believe it was Comey, wasn't it?
No,
Christie.
Who?
It was Chris Christie.
Chris Christie. Okay.
Well. Which may explain why he didn't end up in a Trump administration.
That would have been a little awkward. Is there plans for a sequel? Is there plans? Are you guys now starting to get together and over squash and dinner and starting to talk about how to turn this into?
We met last night and discussed strategies and storyline, and we debated various ways of moving forward. And so the answer is I'm very enthusiastic about it.
Well, the trick is that, you know, between now and when we post this podcast, or between now as we're recording this podcast, there are probably 5 new news stories that have come out.
Did you
about
say it's going to be 2 weeks?
It's going to be a little less than 2 weeks, but in the hour we're recording this, there's probably missing stuff that's going on. Right.
Time.
And so how do you go about thinking about and planning that and saying, how do we write something? That the irony is, there's a great TV show that we're involved with, The Americans, right? Which is the early 1980s about Russian illegals in the United States. And people ask me all the time, you know, have you been watching it? And the answer is yes, but in tongue in cheek, I say, well, I've got it going on in real life right here in Washington, D.C. in front of me. And if you wrote some of these stories in the newspaper, you'd think it was The Onion at first, because some of them are so crazy and far, but things are happening so fast. So how do you go about figuring out the plot of a book that's going to come out, let's say, in a year or two, that's may get superseded or in the military overtaken by events, by what's happening in the real world?
We do exactly what we did in the past, and that's, you know, be aware of what's happening in the world, and predicting in part where the action's going to be, and so. I think we at least one idea we have of action, which I'm not going to disclose, is one way of going.
Okay. But you know, we were talking over breakfast this morning that when we were writing the book, we thought that the scenarios that we were crafting were really
really over the top. Right. I mean, we wanted the book to be realistic in terms of the science, in terms of the politics, in terms of the geography of Moscow, geography of other places, and we wanted it to be true to history, and I think we succeeded at that. But in terms of the main plot lines, I mean, I remember we would laugh when we were writing.
We wanted it to be exciting.
Wanted it to be exciting and moving. And we thought, you know, we are writing historical fiction with an emphasis on fiction.
That's right.
And the truth is we probably didn't even go far enough. And so if we were to write a sequel, I think we would have the advantage of having looser and farther boundaries. We could be more imaginative and know that the future might catch up to our imagination.
Yeah, you have to have your candidate be in space or something and bring like some science fiction into it to make it so far that it remains fiction moving forward.
Well, a lot of it is predictive. You know, you try and look at what's happening in the world and say, okay, what are going to be the real hot button points in the future? And you know, you might draw a map and just throw darts at it and be as successful that way as intellectually trying to predict it. But, you know, we got it somewhat right in the first novel, High Hand, and hopefully in the sequel we will continue that.
And I think there's going to be a lot that's going to come out. People keep saying it does remind, I know Watergate comparisons are, you know, people think they're lame and so forth, but so much of this reminds me of the development of Watergate and the way people talked, and this story's going nowhere and it's over and we're tired of hearing about it and so forth. And I think there are going to be so many more shocking things that are going to come out that, you know, I think we're at the beginning of this scandal. We're not at the end of it. I think one part of it is the Russians are famous for keeping dossiers that they call a compromat, coming from the word compromise, on all sorts of figures, foreign figures who deal with Russia, visit not just politicians but business people, scientists. They assiduously collect information, and you can be sure that they have a lot of information about Donald Trump, and that very little of it has come out. And I think they're just biding their time, and they're watching to see when some of that information might be useful.
But one aspect of the three of us is that we've all traveled throughout the world and extensively in the Middle East, in Russia, in China, and South America. And so, and we're living here largely in Washington. And this may be a bubble, but it's a bubble that's full of information.
Right. Right.
And that's something, we're avid readers, and we have friends and colleagues and sources who are involved in various aspects of the global environment. And so it's the hardest thing is choosing which of those venues and which of those lines of storyline, to use that word twice, to follow, because there's several.
Right.
That one could, and we were very fortunate, which in our initial book, we'll see how fortunate we'll be in the second one.
Well, we'll have you back. We're looking forward to the sequel coming out, and I'll have you back to talk about it when it does. High Hand is available now anywhere good books are sold. The author on the cover of the book, well, you'll see, is Curtis J. James. This is actually three people that we've had the pleasure of talking to today. Curtis Harris, Jim Rosen, and Jim Ellenberger. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. And look, out there in listener land, if we haven't directly insulted you, we meant to. So we apologize if we haven't gotten around to insulting whatever certain demographic you are. But don't let that sour you on this book. I read it when it came out back in the day, and it was like, wow, this kind of sounds a little bit like what's about to happen. Because you kind of, there are the hints of things when the book first came out, but then now it's pretty eerie about how right they got it. So check it out. Curtis, Jim, and Jim, thank you for talking to us here today. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks, Vince.
Thanks, Vince. Great, great questions.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us on SpyCast. Every Tuesday, we'll give you the most interesting conversations with some of the most intriguing people in the world of intelligence. If you'd like to send us a comment or suggestion, you can email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Or tweet us at @intlspycast. That's intlspycast. The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution. To help support future educational programming,
please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.